This is a forum. It is not a lecture. It is a kind of town meeting. It's an opportunity to talk and to listen and to share, to recognize that truth doesn't begin or end with any one of us. It is an opportunity to work through together, conversing about a particular issue. So we have three people up here to make some kind of opening statement. We've talked with one another actually quite a bit. I don't know that we even know what one another thinks. I don't know that we even know what each one of us individually. I mean, I don't know if I know what I think. You may. But it is definitely not, from our point of view, the presentation of a pro and a con or some such thing. It's a lot more complicated than that. We're not going to vote. I think it would be inappropriate to cheer one another if someone says something that we like. The atmosphere is one of quiet conversation. I don't think that the topic needs any particular justification. We're all here because we realize that it's a very important issue on which each of us ought to make some kind of responsible decision. And the three of us are here. My name is Jim Burtness. I teach at Luther Seminary in St. Paul. And I work in the field of theology and ethics, and I have some interest in the abortion issue because of that. I also have some specific interest because I've been asked by the Church Council of the American Lutheran Church to do a paper on abortion, and that's a long way off, I'm afraid, but I'm at work on that, and so I have some interest in it from that point of view. But Peterson is an obstetrician and gynecologist practicing in Minneapolis, and Mary McNamara is a graduate of Harvard Divinity School, currently working in a Presbyterian parish, has had some experience in abortion counseling, and is here to say something about that. So Bud will begin with some basic definition of terms, maybe something about what we can say about the beginning of life, so that we at least have some common understanding about terminology.
I thought we should make an effort to talk on common ground and have some, I'd take some of the smoke away from some of the terms that are used. I'll give you the terms that I'm used to using, and I hope that you'll find them somewhat familiar or somewhat common with whatever you might have been exposed to yourself. I guess we don't have to define pregnancy. Pregnancy, gestation are terms that can be used interchangeably. The human pregnancy is generally, a term pregnancy is 40 weeks. Gestation, 40 weeks of pregnancy, or 280 days from the time of conception. That is generally the time expected for a full-term human fetus to be born and be viable and have the best shot at surviving. Abortion is the termination of that pregnancy at some time prior to supposedly viability. Incidentally, the pregnancy itself is generally divided into three trimesters. The first trimester, if you figured it out, divided up equally, it would be approximately between 13 and 14 weeks per trimester. But generally speaking, we think of the first trimester as being the first 3 months or 12 weeks. The second trimester is leading us up to about the 28th week gestation, and then the third trimester going up to the 40th week. In the past, we thought of 28 weeks as being the point of viability. If you draw a curve and on one side put down percent survival, and down here you put weeks. At about 28 weeks, we'll make this 28, let's make this 20 weeks. You would, and this would be 28, and this would be 40 out here. You'd gradually start, and at about 28 weeks, you'd have, say, a 1% survival. It starts going up fairly rapidly, and at the 34th week, would be reaching a point of reasonable viability. Then it goes on a very steep upward climb. You never reach 100% because, as you know, all babies don't survive, and it tapers off, of course.
Prenatal mortality rate's about between 2 and 3%. So, viability, on the other hand, has become somewhat flexible, especially in recent years, with the increased sophistication of laboratory work, the ability of the pediatricians. Incidentally, neonatology is especially a subspecialty of pediatrics now, with its own boards and specialty training. And those people have worked out laboratory tests, therapeutic measures that have pushed this 28 weeks gestation viability point back. And we do see, you know, the 1, the 1.5, the 2, admittedly very rarely. On the other hand, they do survive, and noticeably more frequently. Not only survive, but survive with better quality than they used to. Just a note that we try to determine the time of the due date of a pregnancy, calculating 4 weeks to 40 weeks out. By incidentally, we go back 3 months, and then the other way 7 days, and that's from the first day of the last menstrual period, and that's the due date. On the other hand, if a person ovulates late, they'll get pregnant late and they'll be due late, which may change that due date. So we have, therefore, we feel the necessity for trying to determine where the patient is in their pregnancy. We can do that, first of all, by watching the height of the fundus. These are the inguinal folds, the umbilicus, subcostal margins. At 18 weeks, the uterus will rise approximately one finger breadth below the umbilicus, and we'll hear fetal heart tones with an ordinary fetoscope. On the other hand, if we take ultrasound, what we call a Doppler, use the Doppler effect, at 12 weeks, or just a little bit past 3 months, we can hear the heart tone. So, I mention that because the fetal activity is heard also at 18 weeks, or is felt at 18 weeks by the mother, approximately. But there are things going on in the uterus from very, very early, and of course, from then on. So we try to set up certain milestones along the pregnancy to tell how far along the patient is, including listening with the dot tone, hearing it with a normal, first of all, of course, the menstrual history, the height of the fundus, the dot tone, the fetoscope, later on the size of the height of the fundus, getting higher and higher in the abdomen. And then finally, the rightness and descent of the rightness of the cervix and descent of the head. To get back then, those are some of the guidelines that we go with as far as as far as pregnancy is concerned. Abortion, as I said, is the termination of that pregnancy prior to the time of livability of the fetus. Now, there are different terms there. Threatened. Just plain threatened is a pregnancy
in which there is vaginal bleeding. Now, essentially, all bleeding in any pregnancy is felt to be a threatened abortion, that is, within the first two trimesters. Sometimes you will examine the vagina or the cervix and find other reasons for the bleeding, but if it's coming from inside the uterus, it's a threatened abortion, it's a threat to that pregnancy, and a high percentage, maybe 20-25% of pregnancies will have some bleeding during pregnancy. Threatened, the next one would be spontaneous abortion. Incidentally, you'll notice I haven't used the word miscarriage. That's a social term. It's a term that's used by people, I think, because of the connotation of the term abortion, as it's been used in the past. And it's not a medical term. We prefer not to use it. I must admit I do use it, because if you say abortion to a person, especially a threatened youth, if you tell a patient she has a threatened abortion, well, your eyes, of course, light up like saucers, and you wish you hadn't said it, really. So we do use the word miscarriage with some misgivings. Anyway, but they're all abortions of various types. Spontaneous abortion is one that takes place without any iatrogenic, man-made influence. Spontaneous. It can go from threatened usually into spontaneous abortion, and then it can be, at that point, it can be incomplete or complete. If the entire conception or the pregnancy, the fetus and the placenta, is aborted by itself without any instrumentation, surgery, then it's a complete abortion. If, on the other hand, part of the conception is passed, but not all of it, then it's an incomplete, and then this, one way or the other, either again spontaneously or surgically with a DNC, would be completed. So you could have a spontaneous, incomplete abortion completed surgically or completed spontaneously. Once any part of the conception, once any part of the pregnancy or the fetus has been passed, then the ball game's over. A new, this pregnancy is lost, whether there is more tissue in the uterus or not, and it has to be completed. There is nothing to be saved from then on. Anytime part, not a clot by any means. I mean, we can have clots and still be in this category right here, the threatened abortion. But once any part of the pregnancy tissue, that is the placenta or the fetus, has been passed, then that pregnancy is essentially over and is over from all practical purposes and has to be completed. Spontaneous. Induced abortion then would be the next great class, next big classification. And this can go on, and this can be subdivided into various groupings. Induced would obviously imply some outside force, usually man-made, or person-made, I should say. And in the past, we used to see a fair number, a moderate number, let's say, of criminal induced abortions. Criminal abortions would simply imply that someone of less than optimum medical background or surgical background would have induced that abortion, oftentimes with poor surgical technique. They did, in fact, go on and create sometimes some rather serious serious results as far as the mother was concerned. Pelvic infection, perforations of the vagina, perforations of the vulva, perforations of the uterus, septicemias, that's bacteria in the blood, and get into some rather serious conditions. It's hard to say how many of those criminal abortions ever actually got into serious trouble, but probably a moderate number. We obviously didn't know about all criminal abortions. Since the liberalization of the abortion law, there are relatively few criminal abortions, and the therapeutic therapeutic abortion or elective abortion or another term, voluntary DIP, which doesn't have the usual implication, rather voluntary interruption of pregnancy is a term that you see on surgical schedules frequently, voluntary interruption of pregnancy. And then one final grouping is missed abortions is a situation in which the conceptus, the pregnancy, has ceased to grow. It is in fact dead tissue within the uterus and has not yet passed. There isn't any significant amount of vaginal bleeding or uterine irritability and cramps, but still the conceptus is confined within the uterus, and none of it, of course, in the vagina, and none of it in the cervix. Those are the terms. Has anybody got any questions thus far?
Did you distinguish between a DMC and a serum abortion?
Generally speaking, the DMC, dilatation and curettage, or dusting and cleaning is another word. is usually confined to, it's a diagnostic procedure, by the way, used for diagnosing and curing menstrual disorders. But it's in this field is used for emptying the uterus of the pregnancy or of the remaining portion of the pregnancy in an incomplete, maybe, of the pregnancy tissue. And it's usually carried out up to approximately 12 weeks. And from there on, the DNC becomes so mechanically difficult to empty the uterus of a fetus with some bone structure and a fair amount of mass and a lot of placenta and a lot of bleeding, so that you find that taking it out through an undilated cervix, that is getting the cervix dilated up enough to get enough instruments in there and empty the uterus without a serious, significant amount of maternal bleeding, that they then move on to ways of creating labor to push the conceptus, the pregnancy, down through the cervix, actually create labor, and that then dilates the cervix, after which then you can go in and clean out the uterus. So, up to 12 weeks then, we can use a straight DNC to empty the uterus. After 12 weeks and on up, however far you go, you need something in this uterus. And so what you do then is to inject saline, hypertonic or concentrated saline. In the past, hypertonic or concentrated glucose has been used, although saline is preferable. There are other things that are used to make the uterus contract, which would essentially be the same as the saline abortion. But the saline abortion is a different ballgame than the DNC. It's more difficult, and of course, as they say, maybe associated with the DNC, but not.
Would be helpful, Bud, to also mention the hysterotomy or abortion by cesarean section.
It's done, and That's a foot dragger. you'd try a lot of saline on at least a couple of occasions, and then also running in something we call oxytocin, which is a posterior pituitary hormone that stimulates the activity of the uterus and makes the uterus contract. And on the other hand, at times, if you have a uterus, cervix, make an abdominal incision of some kind, and then make an incision in the uterus there. Well, at that point, you'd have to make a vertical incision and empty the uterus out and then close that incision. And also, incidentally, we would, at that point, be fairly anxious to have the person have a tubal ligation.
We're simply getting some initial statements out, and we're going to have a conversation as soon as we do that. You should continue, Bud, and we'll pick up questions later.
The other area that I've been allocated is the question of when does life begin? And I'd rather talk longer about this than the next subject, because it obviously is much more objective and easy to spin off. The other subject is much more subjective, and we should have something like Herb Brokering talk about that, I think. At the time of fertilization, the male and the female cells unite, and by various means they have then a full complement of chromosome and genetic material. There are aberrations, there are abnormalities, obviously, but the vast majority of fertilized ova at that point have a satisfactory normal number of chromosomes and genes, and that person's characteristics are then projected as far as the future is concerned, except, of course, the effect of environment later on. I try to imply in this growth of the uterus that it is in fact a spectrum or a whole, as opposed to being something that takes jumps and moves from one block or one cell into an, I shouldn't use the word cell, but from one category into another category. I jotted down some of the weeks, days and weeks at 3 days, the embryo is a 16 cell embryo. At 7 days, it's gone through enough divisions so that it does in fact have a sphere. It is, in fact, a sphere, and it is implanting in the uterus. At 18 days, it does have a heartbeat. The remnant or the beginning of the heart has taken place, and it's not audible. As I indicated, really the only practical way of determining that is with ultrasound, and that you can pick up at 12 weeks. In addition, and then at 24 days would be 3 weeks, it has the beginnings of eyes, central nervous system,
respiratory system, the gut, kidneys, and the sex has been laid down. At 28 weeks, all the internal organs are in effect and in existence in a form, one in an early form. At 8 weeks, it has bones, muscles, not hard bones, but I mean the vestiges of bones. It's making some respiratory movements. It's about 2.5 inches long. And at 18 weeks, as I indicated, the mother does feel fetal activity, and you can hear it with a just a normal stethoscope. Jim has indicated that he's not sure where he feels, where he fits in some of these things, and I guess that's true to some extent, except that I think that probably on a day-to-day basis I get confronted more with it, and therefore I at one time, I have had to refine my thinking, sort out my thinking, and say, you know, what do I think about this, and what am I going to do about it? Because the problem is there, you know, the patient's in front of you. And so in the refinement of my thinking, I would say that I personally don't feel I'm smart enough to say when there is life and when there isn't life. I think to me it is a continuum, and to say that there isn't any life up to so many days and from then on it is just more than I can quite objectively handle. And to me, I guess I would have to say that my thinking is that life does begin at fertilization and continues on. Now, I would have to say with you, Jim, that you can say those things and you can be objective and hard and fast in that judgment. On the other hand, I am the first one to realize that all we do is not cast in iron, and that the minute you make one of those judgments, you realize, hey, I guess my feet are in sand over here when I start doing something else. But I think that in my thinking, I accommodated to the point of saying I think that life begins early with fertilization and continues on.
Thank you very much, Bud. Mary?
Am I next?
Yes.
I was sitting here thinking I was last, but I'm very relaxed. Uh-huh. I did abortion counseling when we lived in Connecticut a couple of years ago. And I did it because the woman minister I succeeded in my position had done it, and they were desperate to have a woman do it. And I was interested in getting into a situation where I could find out exactly why people who are in a pinch, if you will, or in the situation, would go ahead and choose to have an abortion. So I did undertake to take a share among a group of clergy who had formed a coalition called Connecticut Clergy for Dealing with Problem Pregnancy, or something like that. This group had started because abortions were legalized in New York before they were legalized in Connecticut, and because there were a fair number of illegal or criminal abortions done in the New Haven area where we were working. So there were about 25 clergy involved who rotated through the year and took a couple of weeks at a time and tried to share the burden of the counseling. There was a phone number that was called by the pregnant woman, and she was required, at the time I did the counseling, by Connecticut law, to have 1 hour of counseling before the abortion was done. And many women chose to go ahead and to have a religious kind of counseling rather than to go to Planned Parenthood. So I would get, through this referral, they would call an answering service who would give the pregnant woman my phone number, and I would get her call. Typically, she would call at about 11 and a half weeks. And she would have put off, I don't know if you discovered this, she would have put off this decision until the last possible moment. And then you have to act very quickly. And this was a little bit difficult because I was working in the winter and I was pregnant myself. If the pregnant woman were a minor and could not get her parents' permission to have an abortion, if she didn't feel her parents would understand, and many families in New Haven are Catholic, so the girls just wouldn't consider talking to their parents, then she had to be referred to New York, where the age where abortion could be done without parental consent was lower. And I don't even think they asked in New York Hospital. I think they just went in quite often, just did it. One of the problems we faced was that most people seeking an abortion did not have enough money. And so we had a fundraiser, and he went around and raised funds. And as most of these efforts go, we couldn't keep up in funds with the need for the funding. So those gals who came in at 11 and a half weeks we really crossed our fingers and worked very hard to try to get them into Yale New Haven Hospital and to help them out. I would say that most of the girls that I talked to were teenagers, and most of them did turn out to be able to get their parents' consent for their abortions, and things worked fairly routinely. So there were some unusual cases, and I had thought I would go into this and find a lot of cases where I felt the pregnancy should continue, and I didn't find that so often. And one case, which I'll put before you, and you can think about it if you like, a woman came in who was 55 or 50. She had silver hair. She was a professional in business out of town. She was pregnant by the father of her daughter's husband. And her daughter and her husband were planning to have a child soon. And the woman felt that she could not continue the pregnancy because of what it would do to her daughter's happiness. And I felt that I could not argue with people like this, and a lot of the cases were really strange or really complicated like that, and would cause incredible family chaos if I, as a counselor, were to attempt to argue with people. I found that most people who came in to see me didn't want to talk one way or the other. They came with their mind made up. They came to fulfill a legal requirement. They would tell me their case history. And what I was most interested in doing was trying to find out what were the factors in their situation which caused them to get into this predicament in the first place. If there was conflict with the parents, and if there was any possibility of referring the girl to a local parish or to some other kind of high school counselor or someone like this, I would encourage that. I found that everybody tried to become anonymous after this whole horrible thing was over as quickly as possible, and they would disappear into the woodwork very quickly. And there was enough work to be done during my time that I really didn't have time to follow people up anyway. So they would come through, and I would do what I could in an hour. And then they would have completed their requirement and go on and get their abortion. In one case, I had a 15-year-old girl come in who had let things go too long. And she didn't know quite what was going on. And her mother was very upset, and they were upper middle class. And they thought they were eligible for DNC, and they weren't. And the girl had to go down to Queens for a saline abortion. And this is essentially very similar to giving birth to a baby. I don't think labor is as long, but it was very, very traumatic for them. And the mother called me afterward to thank me for spending quite a bit of time with the girl. But I think I would say that if any of you find you have a friend or someone comes to you for an abortion, that the decision should be made as soon as possible. And the abortion, if it is going to be done as soon as possible. I don't think usually when people come to a professional such as I was working as, that they come for help in making their minds up. They've already discovered they have an impossible situation. They feel they must terminate the pregnancy.
I'm going to say a word about a couple of documents, and then we'll talk. One is that I'm a member of the American Lutheran Church, and we have had a division in the church known as Social Action and Research. It's now called something else. I forget the current title. of that particular division. But they issue papers on war and peace and economics and pollution and all kinds of things. And there is a gradation there. Some papers they produce are distributed in congregations for conversation. They come back to social action and research. They're redone, sent out again. Some papers are approved by church convention for council of people in congregations. Some are adopted as kind of a church stance on things. But there is a large variety of issues addressed and a large gradation of importance of these documents. So Social Action and Research produced a document on abortion for the 1972 convention of the American Lutheran Church. It was sent back to that division. It was not acted upon. And at the Detroit convention last fall of the American Lutheran Church, October 14, 1974, a document entitled Christian Counseling on Abortion was passed. It was, I think, the most controversial item at the convention. I was there, and the Detroit Free Press, or whatever it is, had big headlines, Abortion Issue Splits ALC. And the write-up said that people were lined up on either side of the issue, that they were not willing to talk with one another, and that this document was going to split the church. That did not happen, but the final vote was 504 and 379 against. So it was a very close vote, and this has now been sent to the congregations with a preface that says it was passed at the American Lutheran Church Convention with such and such a vote. The document is looked upon, I think, as a victory for the pro-abortion forces, if one can call it that, and it is looked upon as a defeat by the so-called pro-life or anti-abortion people, because although the document does talk about taking many things seriously and so on, it is a kind of, on the one hand, on the other hand, kind of document, and does allow for the possibility of people arriving at a decision to have an abortion and a deuced abortion in good conscience. Now, the issue is whether you think it is appropriate for the church to make statements like this at all. What does that mean, that convention passes this 500 to 379? Do you think that's of any use? I think it is, because counseling has to be a far wider term than a one-hour conversation at 11 and a half weeks. Yeah. The church has a responsibility, it seems to me, not to counsel, not only to counsel one-to-one in crisis situations, but to give counsel, that is, to teach, to advise, to state the issues long before the crisis ever happened. So I think it's appropriate for the church to do this type of thing. I also think it's appropriate for the church to lobby, attempt to influence legislation. Law is a many-faceted phenomenon. But one of the things about law that must be taken seriously, it seems to me, is its role in the formation of social conscience. That is, we do not have a conscience about things simply by being born, but that conscience, those attitudes, those notions of right and wrong are formed by the environment in which we live, part of which is the law. And so the church is a group of citizens with a point of view, and if the church can arrive at some kind of common mind on a particular issue, it has every right and obligation, it seems to me, to try to influence legislation. So that's a statement
of my opinion about what, if anything, the church ought to say. A word about the Supreme Court decision. I think maybe most of you are familiar with this, but it is worth noting that the 1973 decision of the Supreme Court did talk about three trimesters. And during the first trimester, it is unlawful, it is unconstitutional for any state to have legislation which would prohibit abortion. It's a radical change in the American situation, and a radical change in a situation which had been the case, I guess, for centuries prior to that time. In the second trimester, the state may, in promoting the interest, its interest in the health of the mother, regulate the abortion procedures in ways that are reasonably related to maternal health. That is, it may not regulate abortion in the first trimester. That is left to the decision of the attending physician. It may make certain regulations in the second trimester, and in the third trimester, a state may, if it wishes, prohibit abortion except where the health of the mother is concerned. And health is defined by the Supreme Court decision in terms of emotional, psychological, mental, social health. So what the Supreme Court decision means is that abortion, induced abortions, are legal, must be legal. A state may not proscribe abortion during the first 6 months, virtually, and it may proscribe abortion during the last trimester, except if the health, broadly considered, of the mother is considered to be jeopardized. Therefore, abortion has become legal right up to the day prior to birth. And that's why I ask about hysterotomy, Caesarean section, because it is the case that induced abortions, if that's a proper term, are done. And in many cases, the fetuses are delivered live, and there gets to be a terribly complicated problem about what that live fetus is. Is it after 28 weeks that a death certificate must be issued?
20 weeks.
Anything that's been in the uterus for 20 weeks,
you have to have a death certificate. Therefore, the law says in a way that anything after 20 weeks is some kind of human being for which a death certificate must be issued. The Department of Health, Education, and Welfare also says something, and I've got these statistics here somewhere that I guess I'm not going to fuss around trying to get, but the issuance of a birth certificate is also involved. And what is the weak thing on that? I mean, for instance, if 20, same thing.
A live birth, and then you have to have a death certificate.
Okay, you have a birth certificate and a death certificate after 20 weeks. But the Supreme Court has said, in relation to the 14th Amendment, the Due Process Clause, that anything unborn is not a person. That is, the Supreme Court has said that even though a live fetus is delivered that must have a birth certificate and a death certificate, that live fetus has no legal right to due process. It is not a person, the Supreme Court has said. And that's why there are people now working at an amendment to the Constitution which would define person from conception on. The situation is further complicated, of course, because There is a an overlap there in viability period, where at the same gestation moment, one live fetus is put in an incubator and another live fetus is put in an incinerator. Same gestation period because of the decision of the people involved. There is also a huge element of fetal research which becomes possible. What do you do with a delivered live fetus? Even if you observe it die and take data, that is fetal research. This is a report from the Hastings Center, Hastings on Hudson, New York, Institute of Society, Ethics, and the Life Sciences. There's a whole issue on fetal research that is a huge problem that is now being dealt with by medical and legal people, and also people at work in ethics. That's something about the church and the law, and we've taken far, far too much time in this opening chat, and hope that at least the stage is set for some conversations. So the floor is open, and it's open for questions, it's open for comments, for opinions. Certainly there are many, many items touching this question that we haven't even begun to mention. What would you like to say?
I have a question, I guess, I direct to anyone that maybe is young. What does God's Word tell us specifically or in general or in any way reflecting on the issue of abortion?
I can answer that very briefly, I guess. On the one hand, it is certainly possible for people who are pro-abortion to make a good case in the context of, I should say, a responsible reading of the scriptures. There is also a possibility for pro-life or anti-abortion people to find lots and lots of support in the Bible. Roman Catholics, for instance, make a great deal of the birth narratives of Jesus in the Gospels. That is, the life of Jesus begins when Mary conceives. We confess in the creed she was what do we how did was she conceived? What is the word? It's gone for the moment. Conceived by the Holy Spirit, do we say that? Yeah. And so that's, you know, conception is when the life of Jesus begins. So they make a great deal of that. They take a passage from Psalm 139, which talks about even before I was formed, God made me and created me and so on, so that kind of again pushes the beginning of life back to conception. There is a word, pharmakeia, I think it is, in the New Testament, which in classical Greek is often used for the use of abortifacient medications, and there are many passages in the New Testament where pharmakeia is used in an extremely negative way. So I guess the response is that there is no clear-cut biblical position. And people on both sides of the question can find support in the Bible. That obviously, you know, could be a whole topic in itself, but that's just a quickie.
Well, it just seems to me that in discussing any issue of this nature as Christians, that the first and the last place we need to go for guidance is God's Word. And for myself, and I confess that I am very uninformed about abortion, and really be interested in finding out the scriptures that apply to it, but I really believe as Christians in making a personal decision about our position on the issue that it's essential that we look to God's word and take that issue to him in prayer and really ask him to speak to us, to give us the answer, and make our stand on that basis.
I'm interested to know if you think the answer is for everybody as a group, or if you think that answer from God through prayer would be to each individual in their decision.
Well, okay. I fully believe that if a person would take the issue to God in prayer, that God would speak to them and would give them the answer. I don't know if the answer would be the same, but you know, I just really believe that it's so easy for us as Christians to go to God's word last, or not even to go to God's word, and to get informed, get all the data and all the information, and then try to go, you know, make a logical decision from all the data that's gathered, just, you know, really be off base on any number of issues if we don't go to God's word.
Okay.
Jim?
Yes, pardon me. Let's go over here and then over here.
Okay, a statement and a question. I think it's fantastic that you define the abortion laws, because I think most people take comfort in the idea that abortions are done when the fetus is a fish. You know, it looks like a little fish that it can't possibly do anything important. And when in fact that is not true. And I have a question for Mary. You said that with the group that you did your counseling with, that they had a fundraiser who obtained money for abortions. I think this is kind of interesting. This fundraiser also obtained funds for girls who, you know, might want to carry their children but did not have money, or did he find homes for them to live in if their parents...
Well, there were two organizations. The other one in town was Birthright. So if we found a pregnant woman who wanted to carry her child, and we tried to explore the options that a woman might possibly have, because we weren't interested in just running an abortion mill through the church, but if she wanted to carry her child, the best source to go to for help would be Birthright, because they were set up with cribs and layettes and counseling, all kinds of assistance for going through the pregnancy. And we also tried to refer people back to their local situations where they could get help in going through a difficult pregnancy from people they knew.
There was a comment over here. Yes.
Yeah. This just came as a passing thought. I was just curious about it because I'm not at all informed on the issue that much. But in the pro-life group, you made this comment that at a certain stage, you can be either into the incubator for life or into the incinerator. In the pro-life legislation, is there anything to follow along the line of being socially responsible and taking away the decision from the mother that the fetus then becomes, or is then put into the incinerator, to the point that the no matter what the mother, she's then relieved of the responsibility of the pregnancy, but then the fetus goes into the incubator and becomes a social responsibility? Just as the unwed mother who carries the child full term and is then put up for adoption?
Okay, that's really a very much of a pinpointing, it seems to me, of one of the basic conflicts, which is the right of the mother over her own body, on the one hand, and the right of the fetus on the other. And in general, pro-abortion people talk about the right of the mother over her own body and do not talk about the rights of the fetus. And in general, the so-called pro-life people talk about the rights of the fetus. And it's very interesting that in the disposition of cases that have to do with estates and wills, for instance, there is, I guess, I don't know very much about this, but from what I've read, there is a great consistency in the courts to award, in the case of the death, let's say of a father, to award what do you call it, the estate or that which is willed, to an unborn child, to the fetus, huh? So that when that fetus comes to term and is born, he or she receives what the father had willed, even though at the time of the death it was a fetus. So there's massive inconsistency in the law. When you talk about pro-life legislation, I don't know quite what that means, except maybe the pro-life amendment that Senator Hatfield and others are working on, which has to do with the definition of the fetus at the time of conception as a person, which would then move that into the 14th Amendment Due Process Clause, which would give rights then to the fetus. There is one suggestion that I've come across entitled The Sacred Condominium, where the author talks about the condominium as a model of joint ownership or joint responsibility, and which tries to say the mother of course has rights, the father has rights, but the fetus has rights, society has rights, and we've got to get some kind of legislation that can take those various rights into combination. But at the present time, it seems to me the Supreme Court decision has specifically stated that the fetus has no rights. It has specifically said that it is not covered under the Due Process Clause of the 14th Amendment.
Jim, in countries that have had abortion legislation for a long time, has there been there's been an increase in the number of abortions done with the passage of that law. Then the number has come down generally. Is that the case? Do you know?
From what, maybe someone else has information on this. I've read a lot of tables of statistics, and I'm unable to decide about that. It seems to me that people on either side can find those kind, I'm not saying that all statistics are insignificant, but those kinds of statistics, particularly from Eastern Europe, the question of the reliability of those statistics is raised by almost everyone.
So you really can't make any sort of judgment, huh?
I don't know, Bud.
What would be the significance of that if it did come down?
Well, I was wondering whether it might be related in some countries or some situations to an increase of contraceptive counseling, sex education, whatever you want to call it, in terms of making people more aware of ways of avoiding pregnancy that they don't want at a particular time. I mean, I don't think that contraception solves the abortion issue, but I think that many people are more comfortable with the thought of contraception than they are with abortion.
Well, abortion is a lousy way of contraception.
Yeah.
Or controlling the...
I read statistics this afternoon about Sweden, where this particular set of statistics claimed that that with every liberalization of abortion laws in Sweden, the number of abortions has raised, the number of illegal abortions, even in Sweden, has raised. Has risen. Thank you very much. But I'm sure that I could go to another source and they'd knock that apart.
Yeah. I was wondering, lest we be driven by, say, a Supreme Court decision where all of a sudden we start to make a moral judgment based on a decision of the court, if we step back, what are the factors that we want to consider when we make a personal moral evaluation of the rightness or wrongness of abortion?
subjectively, what are the things we want to consider when we decide on a personal basis on the morality of abortion?
Okay, that's another very important distinction between morality and legality. You're saying...
Right, that's right.
Right.
So that maybe if we all make moral decisions, eventually that will drive to the legal decision. Right. It seems like right now we're kind of backwards, where once we all see what the gist is of the courts, then we'll make our moral decision. It seems like it should be the other way around. Yeah.
Okay, a very important distinction. The fact that the Supreme Court says you may have an abortion does not mean that everybody has to have an abortion. And it's still possible to say no. And so you want to distinguish, and that's an important distinction between legality and morality. I think the two, you know, interweave, but we've been talking about that. The question is, what are the factors, what are the considerations to be taken when one has to make that decision? And I think we ought to respond to that as a group. Let's just, you know, respond to that question. What would you say? What are the factors to take into consideration? When making a personal decision, we're not talking now about legality, but about morality.
Well, the church has made a statement now, has it not, about life and death in the statement on abortion?
The American Lutheran Church has a statement entitled Christian Counseling on Abortion. Most church bodies, I think, have some kind of document that has been written or passed on or something. That's
how is that referred to the congregation?
No. Simply sent out in a unified mailing.
No. There are four ways that is referred to the congregation.
Right.
Now, how this one was not as a stand.
No. This is, I'll read the statement. I've got to get bifocals here. A statement of the Seventh General Convention of the American Lutheran Church, adopted October 14th, 1974, by action GC74.12.124, as a statement of comment and counsel addressed to the members of the congregations of the ALC to aid them in their decisions and actions. The vote was 500 delegates voting for, 379 delegates voting against adoption of the amendment. It is a statement of comment and counsel.
I might just add, I think that from my standpoint and those of my cohorts, that this and the people having abortions are considering what they're going to do, what their course should be, that this question is I think, one that needs to be asked. I don't frankly think, notwithstanding what Mary said, that it is asked. I don't think it's really asked very often by the mass of, at the present time, by the mass of people that do have abortions or those that talk to them. In my experience in talking to people who do them, or in talking to people who have had them, whereas when abortion was done in isolated areas of the United States, there were, I'm sure, efforts at the counseling. It seems to me that has not been done, and that to nearly as great an extent now as it was before, and that the actual process of abortion is now in a very freewheeling manner, and done in a freewheeling manner, and that question doesn't get asked. And I think that, to get back full circle now where I started, that for me to answer that question, for the patient to answer that question, is extremely important. And I think that the basis for my saying I don't think it's done partly in talking to people, but also this little thing right here, VIP, voluntary interruption of pregnancy. We don't say it's an abortion anymore. We say it's a VIP, which is much easier to put on the surgery schedule than is an abortion. And this, to me, is, I guess, one of the most difficult things about it, is that we frequently, most of the time, I would say, don't really address ourselves to that question. What is taking place?
My feeling is that it is such a difficult question that the courts and any, you know, large body are probably going to eventually cop out and say it still comes down to personal decision. We can give counsel, we can kind of take a position, but it's ultimately up to the individual. You know, the Supreme Court has not made it illegal. They are allowing it. They're not saying you have to. They're just not saying we're gonna prohibit it. So it's still going to come down. All of these are going to come down to a subjective moral decision on the part of the individual. Even if there were a law against it, if a person wanted it and they made a moral decision they were going to do it, they'd find a way.
Okay,
so really
but
it's going to come down to that, it seems, no matter which way we go.
Let them make that moral decision. On the basis of their background and counseling and so forth, and not put it under some other name that is much more acceptable. You had a point this morning. You lost. I lost it though.
The ALC statement, and please come back. You said there were four ways, and I don't know if you know if your thing was responded to or not. But
no,
the ALC. Pardon me.
Yes, it is for comment and counsel. That is, it is not a stand by the American Lutheran Church. It is merely an advisory or we want to give you some background information kind of thing.
And the statement uses the phrase over and over again, developing human life. Now I think that that's a little bit of a cop-out because you can look at that, it's almost like a piece of art, you know, you can look at developing human life, and then you can say, oh, it's just developing, it isn't human life. Or you can look at it and say, it's a developing human life, you know? I think that it's a carefully phrased ambiguity, and I think it's a cop-out. I have a colleague who worked for some time in New York State prior to the abortion law, in an abortion counseling program and fought hard for the legislation that New York passed. He's very much pro-abortion, but he has no question whatsoever that abortion is killing a human life. Huh? What he is fighting for is an acknowledgement of the fact that there are cases where killing a human life, as in war, may be a tragic necessity. And it seems to me, Bud, you're kind of saying that too. Life begins at conception. We ought not to provide one another with mental constructs which allow us to think of that as just a hunk of tissue. And so that's a consideration that's a serious business, which maybe a person's going to decide to do, but it's still very serious business.
I wonder if.
As I recall, the major argument used at the Supreme Court for their decision, adopted, I guess, by the majority then of the judges, was not that this decision now legalized abortion, but that it now put people in a position where they could make this issue, whereas before the law prevented you from making a moral judgment. So now the argument is, for those who adopted the position of the court, that their decision allows you to make that moral judgment. And before that, you simply did not have the right to make the legal right to make a moral judgment. So I think it's kind of a cleaned up situation, which does allow the moral right to exist.
It allows for it, but doesn't provide for it.
You're right, it does not provide it.
And again, I guess I would want to say that I would want always to take into consideration the function of law in the formation of social conscience. That is, what we think is determined at least in part by the laws that are on the books. So our mind is being made up for us to some extent by the laws that are passed. So that a big thing is invasion of privacy. There's no way not to invade privacy. Dick, I sound here like I'm arguing.
Pete?
You know, no, wasn't it? Pardon me, Pete.
I wanted to make a comment on the issue of how of this moral personal choice issue, and I guess I see abortion like war as being a bad solution to a bad situation, and instead of, I think my feeling is, instead of trying to decide, for example, whether war is right or wrong, or if there's a just war or so on, we ought to be spending a lot more effort trying to decide or figure out how we can prevent war, so we are not constantly every 10 years confronted with this issue of war. And that may be a little more difficult, but still I think that's the way that we need to go. We need to avoid having to be put into a situation where we have to struggle with things that are really so vastly enormous. And I don't think that that the issues of peace or the issues of responsible sexuality are easy, but I think that they offer a less painful route if we can move in that direction. I guess I feel that abortion is often used as contraception. I don't have any statistics, but that's kind of my feeling. I think that this happens because in this country, and I think in a lot of places, the attitude, the feeling about sexuality and sexual activity is very murky and ambiguous and not at all easy for people to get a hold of. It's been my experience working with high school students that very often the very idea of being prepared for possible sexual contact is considered to be something that you just don't ever think about. It's you know, how could you possibly think about that? And yet, very often, these same people are in a situation where they have this contact. I think that my feeling is that maybe we ought to begin to think a little bit more about attitudes toward sex and what that involves, and try to work from that end, because I personally am a lot more comfortable with some kind of contraception other than abortion to prevent having to decide this issue. I would rather, I guess, personally make the decision to prevent conception than to end what might be life. But I think that that's not always taken into consideration.
Isn't also the point, at the other end of the scale, you have benign neglect, or you have, you know, what some people are calling death with dignity.
Pulling the plug?
And I don't know that there are a whole lot of, I don't know that we are saying very much about that. And we certainly, and so I wonder if we really have a clear understanding of life.
That's it's another factor. I don't know if we ought to swing over there, but that's certainly related. And it is the case that when people, or in a lot of the literature about abortion, people also swing over to euthanasia and consider that topic. If one talks about what is life prenatally, one starts talking about what is life postnatally. If one starts to define life in terms of awareness or intellectual activity or relationship with people, and therefore rule out personhood for the fetus, then what does one do with born lives that have an extremely low, if any, intellectual capacity, capacity to relate, and so on? So you get all kinds of ancillary, is that a word, problems. And so I think that's another element in the conversation.
Another element is something that probably should have been talked about more along with all these other elements. The girl is or the woman is already pregnant. Here she is deciding whether she should have an abortion or whether she shouldn't. We haven't talked about anything about what she should hang on to, where she, you know. Okay, she should go for counseling, which would help, but where does she, she's got all these feelings just bursting inside of her, and she needs some support. She, here is a group deciding, okay, yes, you can have an abortion, here's a group, no, you cannot. I guess my feeling is we should talk more about it, and more women should speak up, and we should talk about some of the feelings that are going on inside and what we can do to help these young people. As laymen, as Christians, you know, instead of talking about what the Congress is doing and all this other stuff.
We have two responses.
Well, I was just going to say, you said something very important there about women. Unfortunately, it's men that are making most of the decisions on the abortion issue, politically, which is too bad. It doesn't really belong in politics, and it's a shame that it has to be bounced around like that. But the one thing I feel very strongly about, you can argue all night pro and con for abortion, and you can get a thousand different opinions, but you don't know until you have to make the decision yourself what it's like to make that decision. There's no way anybody can tell you how you feel making that decision.
It has nothing to do with politics. To offer up what the moral criteria are, and each person decides for themselves, notwithstanding the law or any influence or inference that the law allows. It's still a personal decision. All we can do is give them the tools to make the decision. It's still going to boil down to it, because nobody, I agree, no one can put themselves in the position of a woman who has to decide. And it's her decision. The law can say it is or isn't, she can then decide. She's the only one who can decide.
Well, even when you give guidelines, there are all kinds of guilt feelings that linger on. And I think it's very hard for people to deal with them, to find anyone to talk to about them, to know that there's going to be a compassionate ear somewhere. And the people I talk to mostly just try to push it down as far as possible, probably because they were quite young. But I think just because it's just so difficult to work out the guilt that goes along with deciding, yes, you're going to go ahead and do it.
We have a hand here and then back there. Let's take over here first.
Okay, I feel like the church should make a definite statement. You know, the women's movement is so strong now, and you have so many radical women saying, you know, your body's yours, do, you know, you can do what you want to. I think we need defensive propaganda. You know, you have young girls who are very impressionable, and when I talk to my little babysitters, you know, 13, 14, 15 years old, and read what they're reading, they are just being so filled with, it's your body, do what you want. They're not being filled with, it's a baby, it's a person, it, you know, it will grow up, it will be you, it will be me. And if the church has said, I mean, you don't have to say it every Sunday, you don't have to say it once a month, but if it is said, you know, we are pro-life, we believe in this, at least you've got, you know, positive reinforcement for them, somewhere to turn. I don't feel our young people are hearing the pro-life as much as they are, you do your own thing in your own way.
I think that goes back even further to support in the home. Hearing it at home, or, you know, and going back to the attitudes of sex, going way past, way back further from abortion, you know, going back to, you know, the issue at home.
And, you know, so far you said, you know, throughout the lady who was pregnant by her son-in-law's father, and said to think about that. Well, I think that that woman at her age should have, you know, been a little more careful.
It never can happen.
Oh, it happened to me. I am absolutely a living example. And I do not think an unexpected pregnancy is an easy thing to cope with. You know, I mean, I've done this naturally, and it was a real traumatic thing. I didn't think it could happen to me either. But I hope in 20 more years I'll be a little wiser. Oh, and the other thing, you know, with my unexpected pregnancy, and perhaps this is as good a time as any to tell the story, I went in for my hormone shot. You know, things just hadn't been going right. And I was obviously shocked. My third pregnancy, you'd think by three, you'd know, but I really didn't. And his reaction to my shock, and I know this, I really pray this is an exception, is, well, do you want to carry this child? And I was appalled. We have very pro-life feelings. And, you know, my stomach sank, and I looked at that man, and I thought, if I were 16 and not married, how would I react to that? You know, I would say, oh, I have an alternative. You know, I don't have to have this child. I don't even really have to tell my parents. I have an alternative. And this frightens me. You know, I could change occupations, but, you know, I knew I had the option. You know, a young girl wouldn't.
We go back here, and then we've got some more.
In the law, does the father have the time in case of an unwed mother? In some states now, the father has the right, which isn't correct. Even though if the unwed mother has the child and wants to give it away, they say that the father has some right. Wouldn't this concern to be concerned in an abortion too, or is it strictly the mother's choice, according to law?
The maybe someone else, do you know Bud about that? How does that work?
My understanding is that if the patient is unmarried, that she would give her consent, and that would be all necessary. It's true on tubal ligation. On the other hand, if the patient is in any way married, you know, married, separated, married, in the process of a divorce, if there is a legal marriage there, then of course the husband has to be in on anything, tubal ligation, abortion.
How do the parents enter into the decision? What age is that girl capable of making this decision on her own?
I'm not sure. That may vary from state to state. I'm not sure about that. As far as the Supreme Court is concerned, as far as I know, the language is the pregnant woman, the mother. There is no provision in the language of the Supreme Court decision for the father, as far as I know. We have a couple, pardon me.
And state.
Right. It's a mm-hmm. state.
Yeah,
okay, we have Joanne and then.
Yeah.
Okay, and you had your hand up, I think. Did you? Oh. Okay. All right. Yes.
I've heard of kind of an ambiguous current, you know, in some comments that I'm not sure if I'm hearing it correctly, but one feeling seems to me, and also some things that I've read but not heard here tonight, that this is really not a social issue. I mean, that it's not up to society, or that it's not, you know, to be decided by society. And I think I agree with that, but I'm not sure. I think I'm for permissive law, but I'm not even sure about that. But it seems to me that this whole question just pastes up on the board for us. The kinds of things that we're involved in as a society and a culture, that it's really not possible for it not to be a societal issue. I mean, I could wish almost, you know, I could I don't know how to talk about it because I can't speak, you know, or even think about it as a woman does, and therefore I wish that you know, that there could be a completeness there that there isn't. But it seems to me that decisions made by any of us on any issue have a bearing on us all, and abortion certainly no less. You know, and whether or not how the law goes or how people decide, the whole thing is really chilling. To me, it's just chilling, and particularly chilling when people begin to talk, like I know this lady over here saying about how people, if women are being fed this, you know, your body belongs to you, your body belongs to you. No, it doesn't. My body doesn't belong to me. As long as I think that I belong to me or that I am the center of the universe or something, then something's wrong. I tried to live that way, and, you know, abortions were my problem, but I had plenty of other ones. Trying to make my own decisions and trying to somehow belong to myself. I can't go with that as an operating principle. Maybe there are other ways to come at it. And it seems to me that, you know, that the question is no less vital for men. I mean, we're living in the society, and the decisions we make come out, they have ramifications. I don't know, I could wish that I could see in the future and make some kind of a good prophetic statement that would carry some weight. I can't, but boy, it's a chilling thing to me, I must say, it really is. Just to talk about, you know, lying fetuses, you know, I mean, we don't even know how to talk about it, except, you know, there's something alive, you know, the picture of one going to the incubator and the other the incinerator. Whoa. I mean, maybe that's because I'm thinking, hey, there was a possibility that I wouldn't be, you know. Maybe that's it. I don't know, but it's chilling.
Well, I guess I have a feeling of the necessity of proclaiming some of my views at this point, and or making some pleas in summary. One is that I think it's extremely important that we do in fact think of what we are doing when we do something like this. And just from a personal standpoint, I guess if I'm confronted with a decision of trading one life for another life, I can do that, and have done that. I guess, but I think the stakes are high, and I think that the seriousness is great. Number two, I think that it's important that the individuals have all the tools that are necessary in order to make a good judgment, a moral judgment, on this extremely important decision. And certainly that's much more true of those people that do have Christian feelings and beliefs, and I would think that it's the least we can do is to provide them with that. I don't know, the church should go a step back from there and say we're going to take care of your sexuality and your contraceptive needs and all that, because I think that, you know, there are other ways of approaching that. And it seems to me that as such the church should have a pretty clear-cut statement of some kind and pretty proficient available counseling means that would, as I say, help these people in those circumstances.
I was going to say, I think that we could obviously go on all night. I think that we should draw to a close, but let's get your comment before
we close. It seems to me that I see the church's role as being somewhat twofold in this, and that I really agree with what you're saying on providing adequate counseling for people. I really see that as a definite role of the church. I also see a role as Christians to affirm the individual that has to make that decision regardless of which way it goes. It's especially scary to me to think of the number of young girls that are probably making this decision without any kind of counseling at all. And I think that it's really important to affirm the person regardless of what decision they make.